So please do sign in when you're here and go back to previous weeks and check them off if you need to, so that we get a reasonably accurate picture of who's here when. I'll wait for just a moment while people do that. If you weren't here last week, I brought extra copies of the article that we read together, and they're sitting on the table there. I have it. I guess it's a Word file. Ken sent it to me. Yeah, and then I made Xerox copies.
I can email it to you.
Yeah, email it to him. Although I don't.
You'll still have to go to the Wall Street Journal.
No, it's no good. You behind a paywall.
Yeah. So how do we get it?
The answer is you don't have it.
Okay, I don't. Yeah. I don't know how I printed up 120 copies. I don't know how I did that. Thank you so much. Okay, we went over it last week. Okay, let's get going. So I wanted to say some things about mindfulness before we sat, because I didn't get to ask. I had 8 questions, and I only got to ask the first one to Nancy and Joe. So I thought I would kind of address some of the others myself. The question comes up, how sitting with your eyes closed, paying attention to what's going on in your own mind, has anything to do with helping the world? Okay? And that the corollary question to that is, what's the relationship between mindfulness, which is just open awareness, and compassion? In Buddhism, there are 2 different meditations that people do. They do mindfulness meditation, they do metta meditation, which is a meditation particularly on opening your heart. You know, if one is more opening the mind, the other is more opening the heart, and they do these together. But I wish to suggest that even if you've never heard of metta meditation and don't practice it, what I think it would be a good thing to do would be do a little metta, do a little putting people in your heart or flowing love out to people at the end of your mindfulness sitting. Because then you're very focused and very calm and can really make a full opening. Or you can do metta meditation in place. Some people do metta instead of mindfulness. They like it better. But I combine them. I just, in the end of every mindfulness session, I spend a couple of minutes and I put the people that I care about in my heart, and then I try to open that out to people I don't care so much about, and people I just wish everybody the best, and they'll all behave better. So it's an expanding kind of circle of compassion. In any event, even if you never did that, compassion and better connection to other people and concern for all of us would arise from your mindfulness sitting in the following way. When you sit, you become more self-aware. Instead of being lost in your thoughts and your personality, you kind of watch it, and you see, oh, that's my thoughts. And for a while, your thoughts are predominant, and you're mostly they're mostly what you watch. But after a while, the feelings start to reemerge into awareness very richly. And the emotional component becomes more compelling and more powerful and more fascinating than the intellectual stuff, which is just the same old going through, you know, just the characters change, but the themes don't change, you know. So when you become more emotionally aware, when your heart, it's like your heart, the defense against feelings crumbles and your heart opens more and more and you become more and more emotionally rich. And when you do that, you realize how connected, that your emotions are all about other people and how connected you are as an individual to everybody else because of the emotional process, but it is indicated by the emotional process. And so you, even sitting with your eyes closed, you realize how part of everything you are and everybody you are. And then when you open your eyes and you walk out into the world, you don't walk out mindless again. You still retain more and more mindfulness. So you're more aware not only of how you're reacting to others and how you could interface with them better and how you're feeling with them, but you also are much more perceptive about where they're coming from, how they feel. You can feel how they feel. And when you meet so many people that you meet that are kind of lost in their own thought process and their own drama that they're creating and their own mistaken ideas about themselves, then your heart just opens to them because you can see that they're just lost in this maze of their own creation. And if they just would come out of it for 1 second and forget about who they were and come to just being with you in that moment, they'd be fine. So your heart just spontaneously opens to see the suffering of other people when it's there, and also how much of that is created by them, self-created. But even if it's not suffering, your heart opens up to other people, because when you're sitting, you're not only listening to them, talking to them, you're feeling how you feel, and you're feeling how they feel. And so you're feeling the heart-to-heart connection, not just words-to-words, head-to-head connection. So the practice of mindfulness makes you more aware of your own heart, and then more aware of the connection, and more aware of other people and their heart process, right? Well, this is pretty obvious. So I think that as people become more aware, as people become more self-aware, they'll also, out of that, will grow more awareness of interconnection and other people, and that'll save the world. We hope, but you know, it could be looked at that the reason that mindfulness is becoming mainstream now is because it has to. Because the issues that are facing the world are so acute that some major evolutionary step forward has to happen in order for the world to continue to be viable. And Pierre Teilhard de Chardin said many years ago that it seems like evolution is putting all its oomph into human consciousness. And I think human consciousness is making a big step forward now. I mean, mindfulness is so obvious. How come we didn't figure this out when we were 3? How come people didn't tell it to us? I mean, it's so bonehead simple, but it wasn't in the collective consciousness to understand that you're not your thoughts and your feelings. You're something that is aware of thoughts and feelings. You're something deeper than that. You're something more elemental. You're something larger than that. We just didn't know it. Some people did, but most of us didn't.
And you know, religion didn't help either.
Because
all religion had a contemplative aspect,
yes.
And they squashed it to replace it with rigid beliefs and controls.
Yeah.
So they developed zombies instead of growing up beings.
Absolutely. But the point is that people knew, you know, that all these spiritual traditions came from these basic understandings. They just got lost in the human stuff that went around them. Okay. So that's the first thing I wanted to tell you about mindfulness. Okay. Second thing I wanted to say today before we sit is, you look at how I phrased it. When you sit, you become more self-aware and less self-involved. There's a complementary and opposite process that happens. That is, as you sit, you begin to open up the blocks or the defenses that you have learned to walk around with in order not to get hurt anymore. The world is a symphony, you know. It's just, sometimes the timpani goes, and sometimes, you know, the buzz saw goes, you know. So, you know, we all have these closures, these blockages, because of we got hurt. And many of us have a lot of blockage around the heart. Because of what happened earlier in our lives, we've learned to not pay attention to that. To suppress that process and instead go to our heads, where we can kind of be clever and figure things out and stay out of trouble, or stay out of pain. And when you sit, you gradually open, because this is all about softening and opening. You gradually open up to all the levels of yourself that you defended against. So your defenses open gradually. So you learn a lot about yourself and who you are at deeper and deeper, more and more basic and ultimately huge levels. But and so that's when you do learn, when you start to feel certain things or realize certain things, then you become very fascinated by those things. And you think, well, I got to do something about that sadness, or I got to do something about that anger, or that, you know. And so you kind of get pulled into the new stuff that comes up. And for a while, it fascinates you, or it terrifies you, or it horrifies you, or it does whatever it does, you know. But the instruction is always to take a step back, to take a step back, to come to the awareness, not the things you're aware of. And so you, as you're becoming more self-aware, if you're practicing, you're becoming less, you're operating less on what you see. You're becoming non-attached. What you experience is simply what you experience. It's not you. You are the one experiencing the stuff. You're the experiencer. That's the stuff that's being experienced. You're the searchlight. That's the stuff that's getting illuminated by the searchlight. So the practice is about being more and more and more aware of every level of experience and being less and less impelled to do anything about any of it. When you do decide to do something about it, you do it very consciously, very skillfully, and very circumspectly. You don't sit there and say, oh, I'm going to sit down now and I'm going to make myself better. You know, that's not mindfulness. That's self-improvement project. So what that means is you might have an intention before you sit, for each sitting. You might say, okay, I would like to be more calm. I got to be calmer. So that's your intention before the sitting. But if you bring that intention into the sitting, you'll do the opposite. You say, I got to get calmer, and you'll actually make more agitation. You know? Or I got to get rid of that sadness. Let me see if I can morph that sadness, or this, that, that. You know, you'll just kind of get more stuck in the sadness. So when the intention can be there before you sit, each sitting, or in a program of sitting, but once you sit, there's no intention. There's just being okay with what is. And if you're not okay with what is, there's watching the not okayness, and that being okay with the not okayness. You can always take a step back from whatever. So, you know, we shouldn't judge. So we're sitting there, we're thinking, I'm not going to judge. I'm doing really good at not judging. Wait a minute, I'm judging that. And they go, so what do? Do you suppress the judging? That's another judgment. No, you don't suppress the judging. What you do is you take another step back from that, and you go, oh, look, judging mine, judging that. So I got several levels of mind going on. I got a judgment mind, judging what I'm thinking mind. And you just step back, and you step back, and you step back. And you accept that it's all doing whatever it's doing. And by not being attached to it, by coming from this purely cognizant place, this conscious but non-involved place, everything has a tendency to... all the eccentricities have a tendency to reconfigure themselves in concentric ways around this perfect center. So by not trying to fix yourself, but by simply accepting what you find, everything gets better. It self-corrects. And when you need to help that process along, you do it very consciously, very skillfully, but not compulsively. That makes sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I mean, but I was brushing my teeth this morning and all kind of, all right, what am I going to talk about today? Oh. All right.
You had a packed schedule.
Oh my God, I had a packed schedule. You have no idea. All right, so let's sit for 10 minutes.
Come on.
So you heard all that, as Fritz Perls would say, elephant shit. Let it all go. Three simple instructions, three steps. Step one, find your breathing. Step two, let everything soften and open. Step three, notice whatever you experience without trying to do anything about it.
There you go.
No, leave it.
What's it?
We're missing your R.
Yeah.
Have to okay, we have
you get your guy. I'm sure you got it memorized. Okay. So here goes, 10 minutes. Okay? So a few weeks ago, three to be exact, we were talking about the building blocks of well-being. Remember? And I made the acronym High School Opera, HS Opera. And we have, to this point, talked about...
You've got some of the announcements.
I don't have any announcements.
But the super one that I need to write to the super one?
Okay, Julie lives on the west side, and she needs a ride to Mind and Supermind on Monday, the 23rd of October. So if you can give her a ride, see her at the end of class. Okay? Okay?
Right.
We'll see what happens. She lives off San Andreas Street. Fairly close to City College. All right, so H was health. We talked about that well-being obviously has something to do with how healthy you are, and that especially we talked about the fact that it's your perception of your health rather than the objective fact of your health that's most important. Typically, they're fairly close together, but if they're not, you know, some people that have major stuff wrong with them still feel basically vital and healthy, and so that contributes to their well-being. Second one was security. We talked about the fact that one needs to feel safe in where one lives, and also to have the basics of life, to not be hungry or cold. So security is obviously another aspect of well-being. We also talked about the fact that once you have the basics, getting a lot more doesn't really impact your actual well-being. It impacts the story you tell yourself. Oh, I'm much better off now that I have much more than I did before. But in terms of how you actually live, it doesn't really do that. It's the way we say it is, poverty certainly brings misery, but riches doesn't bring happiness. You need, once you get enough, then more doesn't really impact how you feel moment to moment in your days. It does impact what you say to yourself, however. That was the edge, S. And then O was optimism. And we talked about optimism as being not something, the way it's usually thought of in the culture is only seeing the half full part of the glass. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about seeing that the glass is half full as well as half empty. Because we have a negativity bias. We tend to see what's wrong more vividly than we see what's right. So we have to keep reminding ourselves of the actual situation in order to come to an even-handed, accurate view of the world. And when it is possible to affect the outcome, it's really a good idea to think, what's the good outcome and how can I make that happen, rather than not realizing that there is that possibility. So optimism has bounds. People that are too optimistic underestimate the risk in their in society and in their lives, and you know they get in trouble for that. But realistic optimism seems to be a better strategy. For a bunch of reasons, one more of which is that when you are realistically optimistic, it makes you feel better. And when you feel better, you tend to be able to do better. So optimism kind of, in that sense, creates its own result. But that's what we talked about already. So now we're moving to the P and the E. I hope I'll get through the P and the E today. Okay?
Number four.
That, yeah, P is number four and E is number five of the seven.
And what does P stand for?
Well, it can stand for whatever you want it to stand for. Petunias. It stands for pleasure.
Oh, pleasure.
Pleasure. We're going to talk about pleasure a little bit. Pleasure, we feel pleasure when our needs are met. Now, we're going to talk at some point about basic needs. I've talked about it before, but I'm going to talk about it in more detail at some point. I don't know when, maybe probably in the spring. But the point is that there comes a feeling of pleasure when that which we need to be alive is satisfied. So pleasure is really important, because if there's no pleasure in your life, it means somehow your needs are not being met. So people that walk around without feeling any pleasure are lacking something that is vital for their existence. First of all, what's your name?
Mary Jo. What's the meaning of pleasure that you're using it? And is it a synonym? Would it be joy or something like that?
No, I'm actually going to talk about pleasure in more detail, Mary Jo. I just want to tell you why pleasure, whatever, you know, some sort of feeling, good feeling, but of which there are varieties, some sort of good feeling is important, and a life that doesn't have that is a life where the basic needs of life are not being fulfilled. So if you have an anhedonic life, a life of no pleasure, then you've got to ask yourself, what am I missing that I need to be alive? Because anhedonia is an indication of either some brain disease or of a life that's not being lived well. So pleasure is a complicated one. There are two basic motives in the brain. There are two basic drives in the brain that keep us alive: the approach drive and the avoid drive. Right? The approach drive gets us the stuff we need to stay alive, and the avoid drive keeps us from being killed or eaten or somehow not being alive. So these are kind of basic motives. You see them even in one-celled animals. They go toward food and they go away from poison. You know, plants, you see them in plants. Plants grow toward the good stuff and they grow away from the bad stuff. So the point is that these two basic motives are what life operates on. Get the good stuff, avoid the bad stuff. So the brain is complicated, and so these two motives are distributed in various areas of the brain. It's not like you only have one little pleasure center here and one little avoidance center there. These are complicated processes. So what that means is there are a lot of gradations and kinds of pleasure. So I'm going to break them down into two basic clumps. But within those clumps, people who are more hedonically oriented could probably parse those clumps out into more detail. So the two clumps are the sensual pleasures, the direct sensual pleasures that come from the satisfaction of the senses, and the more complex pleasures, which typically have to do with thinking, cognitive function. Okay? So the two kinds of pleasures are sense pleasures and pleasures that have to do with thinking.
Okay? That's number two.
That's number two. That's the more complex kind of pleasure. Okay. So the sensual pleasures, we've talked about, so I'll just briefly mention that one area that's really important for the sensual pleasures is the so-called reward pathway in the middle of the brain, in the limbic system. And that reward pathway works on the neurotransmitter dopamine. And what happens when, by the way, this is not the only place that sensual pleasure happens. You get a back rub, endorphins get released in your brain, and oxytocin gets released. So there's a lot of stuff going on here, okay? But let's just focus particularly on the reward pathway in the middle of the brain. So you eat a bite of chocolate, and it tastes really good. That reward pathway is activated by dopamine, and you go, wow, that was great. And then the dopamine level rapidly falls in that pathway, and that's not so great. And you think, I want another one. Okay? It's not so fun to have the pleasure fade, and it fades really fast, so you're impelled then to go get another bite, take another bite.
Well, not good, right?
What?
Not good, right?
It's not good to when the pleasure leaves.
And then it's like eating disorder?
Eating disorders have a lot of causes, but one cause might be, for the overeating, might be too much reliance on that way to get pleasure, because the rest of the life isn't providing enough. So the person can't stop eating because it's the only thing that gives them any pleasure.
See, I've been eating before, so I have that kind of problem.
You're not alone. Eating disorder, you know, difficulties about it, it's sleep and eating, or, you know, probably a majority of the population has some issues with sleep and eating. Maybe they don't rise to the level or fall to the level of major clinical disorder, but most people have some eating that they shouldn't be doing, or don't do some eating that they should be doing. Okay. Anyway, I want to go back to this. Okay. In nature, that impulse to get it again is a healthy impulse. Because in nature, that which gives you immediate sensual pleasure, which is what animals get, they don't get the cognitive pleasures, they get the sensual pleasures. That which gives you pleasure is life-giving. It's built in. That's why we have this system in our brain, to get us to do it again. Go get that again. Because it's life-giving. That's food. That's procreation. That's shelter. You know, get that again, because that promotes your life. So we have this drive to get as much pleasure as we can, sensual pleasure as we can, because in nature, that will give us the most life-building stuff. However, human beings have invented pleasures that are not life-giving. And they, unfortunately, they're life-taking. And they also, because they've been cooked up in laboratories and other places, they're incredibly powerful. So they're hugely reinforcing. And so the impulse to get it again is really strong. So the potential for craving and being impelled to get more of bad stuff is built into the brain. The bad stuff is an add-on, but the craving process is built into the brain. So fortunately, nature gave us a counterbalance. When it gave us the intelligence to cook up bad stuff to tantalize us, it also gave us a prefrontal cortex, because the prefrontal cortex is the thinking part, and that's the more uniquely human part. That's the part that can cook up drugs and alcohol and other and super sweets and all the other stuff that, you know, and gambling and all the other stuff, and shopping and porn and all the other stuff that people get addicted to. It also, the same process that can cook that up also has some control over the middle of the brain. The top of the brain, the front part of the brain, has some control over the middle of the brain. So even though we have all this bad stuff, we have a top of the brain saying, that's the bad stuff, don't go there, or don't do that again, or moderate that. Yeah, you can have one slice of chocolate cake, but you cannot have the whole cake. At least not tonight. In a healthy human being, the prefrontal cortex has decent amount of control over the limbic system, especially over the pleasure center, over the reward pathway. And you, even though you want the second piece, you don't have it. The problem is this: the middle of the brain is evolutionarily older than the top of the brain, and so more powerful. And the top of the brain has to kind of do a good job of riding herd on the middle of the brain. Once it starts to lose control, it loses control fast. And then, even though you're very smart and very self-controlled in some ways, you just cannot resist a cigarette. You know, you get hooked on this.
Are we still on sense pleasure?
Say again?
Are we still on sense?
We're on sense pleasure. Right. Yeah. So what's important is to, if you realize that, you know, I just don't have control when it comes to this area, then you have to enlist help. You have to get other prefrontal cortexes to help you regulate your reward pathway, you know, because you just can't resist chocolate, or you just can't, and you have too much of it. And so you have to kind of start putting it on a calendar, how much you had, and calling up your best friend and saying, how much did you have today? You're in league with me, how much did I have today? And so you get help. Okay. And some pleasures, you just don't go, some sensual pleasures that we cooked up, you just don't go near. You don't shoot heroin. Because, you know, people can, it's so intensely pleasurable, it's said, that a lot of people, they, it's one time they do it, and then they lose control, you know. So anyway, but we talked about that before. So what do you do about sensual pleasures in order not to overdo, to overindulge? You do two things. You vary them. We'll come back to vary. You spread them out in time. You don't, you allow them, but you make some rules about how much you can have when. Okay. Okay, more cognitive pleasures. Much of the pleasure we feel isn't directly sensual. It has to do with thoughts we have of being satisfied with what we have just done or what we are doing. You know? So it's much richer. What do I want to say about that? I'll come back to that, okay? There's another problem I didn't tell you with sensual pleasure, which is that we adapt to it very rapidly. It loses its appeal really quickly. That is the first piece of, let's use another example. The first bite of, the first bite you have of a pizza tastes really, really good, okay? And then the second bite you taste tastes really good too. And the third bite you taste, well, you don't really taste it, that's the problem. If you really tasted it, you would see that the first bite's a 10, the second bite's a 10, the third bite's a 9, the fourth bite's a 7, the fifth bite's a 5. What happens is the taste receptors get used to the pleasure, and so they fire less often. So you're getting less message from whatever sense it is that's being repeatedly used in the same way. So it's called the hedonic treadmill, which is the pleasure fades, and then you have to run forward to get it again, and then it fades again, fades again. What do I want to say about that? Two things. First, we generally, because we think a lot, we generally aren't directly in touch with the sensual aspect of what we're doing. We're partly in touch with it, but we're also in touch with how we're thinking about it. And so the reason that people scarf a slice of pizza and then say, I want another slice, is because they haven't really had the sensual pleasure of the pizza, because they're busy thinking about something else or talking to somebody else or thinking this is good, but they're not actually paying attention to the sensations that are coming in. So they don't know that it's going 10, 10, 9, 7, 5. If they did, they'd put it away in the sixth bite. They go, it's a 2 now, you know, why do I want any more? And also, I'm satisfied because I've taken full measure of the pleasure. If part of the reason that we consume is because we want to feel pleasure, then if we take full measure from what we consume less. But if we don't, if we're ignoring the pleasure that we get because we're thinking about other things, then, or thinking we're having pleasure rather than directly having it, then we keep wanting to have it because it doesn't fill us up. You know, we eat for two reasons. We eat for the nutritive reason. We also eat for the pleasure reason. And if you don't take the pleasure, then you're going to keep eating and keep eating because you haven't gotten the measure of pleasure that you need. Does that make sense to people? Again, I'm trying not to get too complicated about it. So when I worked in the weight control program at Sansom Clinic, I had people who were, had gone through a medically supervised fast program and lost a great deal of weight. Some of these people were really morbidly obese and had, if they didn't lose weight, they'd die. And so these were people with some serious issues. So they would lose a great deal of weight in this medically supervised fast program. But the problem was not the losing of the weight. If you give people 420 calories a day, they're going to lose weight, you know. The question was, would they keep it off, right? And as you know, the statistics are not very good about losing weight. You lose it, and you gain it, you lose it, you gain it. And sometimes you gain more than you lose. And every time you lose weight, you depress the basal metabolic rate in the body, and then it doesn't quite go back up to where it was before because you've depressed it and it doesn't rebound entirely. So you keep cyclical serial dieting. Each time it gets less successful because the basal metabolic rate is lower and lower and lower. So you have, what that means is you consume less and less calories. You can consume less and less calories. Anyway, I'm sorry, that was complicated. That was complicated. Back to the story. So these people have lost weight. The question is how they're going to keep their weight off. They go into a year-long maintenance program where they come every week and they report on what they're eating and they get their weight checked and they get more lessons about how to eat in a healthy way. And the people that came to that program maintained their weight loss. The people that faded away, I got rid of my weight, they all gained it back. So part of that maintenance program was something that I cooked up called the ceremony of eating. And the ceremony of eating was this thing that we did for just some people, not everybody in the program, just a few times I did it. We made the lab, or the place where people were meeting, into a restaurant. We brought we put drapes and we made candles, and we invited people who wanted to do this, who volunteered to do this, to bring in their to die for food. Or they're to die from food. And we had ways to keep the food warm, and we had ways to keep the food cold and frozen, so we had everything we needed. And I taught them mindfulness. And so they learned how to be mindful. And then on the evening of the ceremony of eating, we lit the candles, and it was a whole beautiful thing. And then people came in, and they brought their foods in, and they were really scared, because these are the foods that they had to stay away from, because they had no control over. These were their, the food they liked the most and made them the had the most problem with. And so that we sat down and we went through a long mindfulness process, and then the foods got brought out, and the people had to look at the food and smell the food and then go back to being mindful and then write down how they felt and then go back to, and they had water so they could drink water. It's like wine tasting with water in between. Okay. And then they got to taste a very little bit of whatever food it was. Chocolate was very prominent, as you might imagine, but all kinds of other things showed up. They got to taste a little of this food, and they had to be mindful and taste it. They got the full, you know, what does it taste like? How long does the taste last? Is there an aftertaste? And then they rated the taste from 0 to 10, drank some water, sat again for a few minutes so they were mindful, then take a second taste and do the same process. And they could have as many tastes as they want as long as they were mindfully tasting and waiting between tastes. And people wrote that, you know, and you saw what people wrote, 10, 10, 10, 9, 8, 6, 4. And it was remarkably successful in that people got, after a while they didn't want any more. It was such a rich experience. They'd gotten so much pleasure out of what they had tasted that they figured they were done. There was no more pleasure to be gotten, and the taste was kind of lower than it was. The sense receptors had kind of adapted. So one guy, just to tell you one, I don't have any data. We didn't collect good data, but one thing I'll tell you is one guy said, I've been a chocolateholic my entire life. My entire life I've been too much on the chocolate. And you cured, and, oh, this was like 6 months after the ceremony. He said, you cured me in one night. Now I have chocolate, but I do it really mindfully, and I have like five bites, and that's enough. I got the whole deal. I got more pleasure than I ever got eating three Hershey's. You know? So anyway, that's a long story about sensual pleasure. But that the point about sensual pleasure is, it's you want to take the most pleasure from the least consumption.
And actually, before I said to Chris, it's also important to have the quality to make up for the quantity. So if you eat good Swiss chocolate, a few bites is going to be a lot better than eating a pound of Hershey.
Okay, so yeah, that was, thank you. That was the other thing that I didn't say, which is people's take, when you're mindful, as long as we're talking about taste, when you're mindful, your tastes change. Because what you think is good is different than what is actually tastes good. When you eat, for example, chocolate generally has an aftertaste that is not so good. And if you're paying attention to the whole process, the aftertaste ain't real great. So it turns out that people spontaneously move toward more natural foods from more processed stuff. Because the actual taste is too fatty, it's too sweet, it's overbearing. Whereas the natural stuff, which evolutionarily you've learned to love because you know you're very tuned into that seems more satisfying because it's more actually satisfying. You've evolved to have that taste better than this kind of new stuff. Or overblown stuff, or artificial stuff. So you make different choices because of the actual experience rather than what you think will taste good or does taste good. Does that make sense to people? I'm saying that a lot today. I guess I think I'm not making sense.
Except for barbecue potatoes.
But the point is you can have anything. You just have to have it mindfully. So you can eat, there's no such thing as anything that's off limits, sensually. Okay. You can have any sensual pleasure, just check that it's actually giving you pleasure and have it to the extent that you are actually getting enough pleasure from it. Don't act out of supposition, act out of actual experience. Okay. Habituation. Not only do the sense organs rapidly adapt to repeated stimulation, but the brain, after a while, ignores repetitive stimulation. That is, you wonder why people that live right next to railroad tracks can sleep through the night, or people that live right by airports can sleep through the night. It's because the brain has learned to not regard those things, to not pay attention to those things in the same way. It still registers those things, but it doesn't register as strongly. So the problem with pleasures is we tend to... So the problem is, even with the more complex pleasures, the pleasures that we think about, if we do them too often, they don't give us as much pleasure because we're inured to them. The brain has gotten used to them. So if you love a piece of music, if you play it all the time, after a while you kind of don't hear it. So you need to both stay, for both sensual and more conscious pleasures, more cognitive pleasures, you need to both vary them and space them out. Pleasure is necessary, but you want to vary what you're getting pleasure from, and you want to not do any particular pleasure too repeatedly.
And also with drugs, you need to increase the dosage to get the same effect.
Well, that's because that's tolerance. You get used to. So if you want to defeat tolerance, and tolerance can be looked at even on the level of the sense receptors, they get less provoked by the same level of things. So if you want that not to happen, you have to wait long enough so that that process isn't engaged. Carl.
That makes me think of cases of multi-course fine dining, where they give you a palate cleanser between courses to have very different flavors.
Yeah.
It resets your...
And they also don't give you very much of each thing. So the idea is you get a very rich sensual experience, and they also decorate the plates really nice, you know. So you get a really nice sensual experience, but each, you know, you get two or three tastes, just a few tastes of each thing, and then there's a time between courses, and there's a refreshing of the palate, so that the pleasure is prolonged throughout the whole experience, rather than if they just give you a huge mountain of something, in which case you eat it because you paid for it, and and you think it's really good, but what's actually happening is you're not paying attention to what your body is telling you, which is it's too much, and it's overbearing, and it's the same, and I'm not really tasting it, and it's cardboard, and you know. So it's really a question of being more... Being mindful, being aware, allows you to take more pleasure with less consumption. So the pleasures weigh, they give you more having to have less of them.
Do you think it could also be like time travel, where as we become more aware, we can focus more and live more of each hour, of each minute, of each few seconds, and in a way it kind of expands?
Absolutely. If you're thinking about something else, if you're multitasking while you're eating, you don't even perceive it. You know how you don't even perceive that you ate. You know, did I eat that food already? Did I not? I was just so lost in thought. So it goes by in no time. Whereas if you do the ceremony of eating thing, it takes a long time. Okay, I'll tell you one tiny more story about that, and we got to show you a video. So one tiny more story about this is at Esalen Institute, when I was at a mindfulness retreat, part of it was 9 days of mindfulness continuously. You were supposed to never not be mindful. If you did sleep, you were supposed to stay mindful as you slept. So it wasn't like a sitting for a few hours a day. It was 9 days without ever not being mindful, which was a very powerful experience. But one of the things you would have to eat during those 9 days. So one thing would happen would be the people that were on this retreat would have to walk from the big house down the other side of Esalen, if you know it. It's the big house on the other side. They would have to walk to the dining hall and then eat and then walk back to where we were sitting and where were we sleeping also. And so we would walk like a line of monks, you know, and it would take us an hour to walk that 300 yards. Because we were paying attention to every step and stopping after every step. Because you have to. Mindfulness means you pay attention to everything that's happening, everything on every level. So it took us an hour to get there. And then we would go on the line and there's all this food, you know, they grow all this wonderful food. There's all this. So we would like take a little rice and we would bring it slowly back to our table. We were in silence, of course, this whole time. And we would start eating the rice and with chopsticks. And I got to tell you, I would have about 10 grains of rice. Each one was so full of texture and flavor. And it took so long to get it to my mouth. You know? Got really good with chopsticks. And then you'd be done. I'd be completely filled up. I'd have a whole huge experience. And it would be like 10 grains of rice. And then we'd walk an hour back, and that's what we ate. You know, it was like weird. And you lost weight, of course. Okay, anyway. I thought we were going to get to... Colette.
Can you stop early? Because we're starving.
Yeah, I know. It's called suggestion. Okay. Okay, so... What's this, Julie?
You were about to get the OEs, and then we had somebody was asking
questions.
So what about O?
O was optimism, but I haven't gotten yet to E. But I think what I want to do is I was going to show you this at the end of E, but I think I want to show it to you at the beginning of E. Okay, so this is going to be a preface to our discussion of engagement, which E is engagement.
Oh, we're doing E before O?
O, no, we already did O. O is optimism.
What?
Opera.
What number was that?
O is three.
Oh yeah, and five is...
P is four and E is five. So we're going to talk about engagement. The extreme of engagement is meaning. When you're engaged, it means you kind of go out of yourself. And the most compelling form of going out of yourself is going out of yourself into something that's incredibly meaningful to you. So remember that. Let's watch this video, which just came up on TED like 2 weeks ago, on meaning. And then when we talk about engagement, I'll reference that. The reason for that is because next week I have another video to show you if I got to get that far about relationship. So I don't want to give you two videos.
What's
this?
Next, what video is that?
Next week is what did you say?
What video are you
going
to show next week?
I'm going to show a video on, I'm not sure, but probably a video on relationship next week.
Oh, could be R next week?
E next week and maybe R.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so I have to get this. So, what's this chart? You don't need to. Yes, you do need to.
Okay.
Thank you. And what we need is to have the room blackened. So display. Reasonably well, yeah? Take this.
Pursuing happiness. Everyone said the path to happiness was success, so I searched for that ideal job, that perfect boyfriend, that beautiful apartment. But instead of ever feeling fulfilled, I felt anxious and adrift. And I wasn't alone. My friends, they struggled with this too. Eventually, I decided to go to graduate school for positive psychology to learn what truly makes people happy. But what I discovered there changed my life. The data showed that chasing happiness can make people unhappy. And what really struck me was this. The suicide rate has been rising around the world, and it recently reached a 30-year high in America. Even though life is getting objectively better by nearly every conceivable standard, more people feel hopeless, depressed, and alone. There's an emptiness gnawing away at people, and you don't have to be clinically depressed to feel it. Sooner or later, I think we all wonder, is this all there is? And according to the research, what predicts this despair is not a lack of happiness. It's a lack of something else, a lack of having meaning in life. But that raised some questions for me. Is there more to life than being happy? And what's the difference between being happy and having meaning in life? Many psychologists define happiness as a state of comfort and ease, feeling good in the moment. Meaning, though, is deeper. The renowned psychologist Martin Seligman says meaning comes from belonging to and serving something beyond yourself, and from developing the best within you. Our culture is obsessed with happiness, but I came to see that seeking meaning is the more fulfilling path. And the study showed that people who have meaning in life, they're more resilient, they do better in school and at work, and they even live longer. So this all made me wonder, how can we each live more meaningfully? To find out, I spent 5 years interviewing hundreds of people and reading through thousands of pages of psychology, neuroscience, and philosophy. Bringing it all together, I found that there are what I call four pillars of a meaningful life. And we can each create lives of meaning by building some or all of these pillars in our lives. The first pillar is belonging. Belonging comes from being in relationships where you're valued for who you are intrinsically and where you value others as well. But some groups and relationships deliver a cheap form of belonging. You're valued for what you believe, for who you hate, not for who you are. True belonging springs from love. It lives in moments among individuals, and it's a choice. You can choose to cultivate belonging with others. Here's an example. Each morning, my friend Jonathan buys a newspaper from the same street vendor in New York. They don't just conduct a transaction, though. They take a moment to slow down, talk, and treat each other like humans. But one time, Jonathan didn't have the right change, and the vendor said, "Don't worry about it." But Jonathan insisted on paying, so he went to the store and bought something he didn't need to make change. But when he gave the money to the vendor drew back. He was hurt. He was trying to do something kind, but Jonathan had rejected him. I think we all reject people in small ways like this without realizing it. I do. I'll walk by someone I know and barely acknowledge them. I'll check my phone when someone's talking to me. These acts devalue others. They make them feel invisible and unworthy. But when you lead with love, you create a bond that lifts each of you up. For many people, belonging is the most essential source of meaning, those bonds to family and friends. For others, the key to meaning is the second pillar, purpose. Now, finding your purpose is not the same thing as finding that job that makes you happy. Purpose is less about what you want than about what you give. A hospital custodian told me her purpose is healing sick people. Many parents tell me, "My purpose is raising my children." The key to purpose is using your strengths to serve others. Of course, for many of us, that happens through work. That's how we contribute and feel needed. But that also means that issues like disengagement at work, unemployment, low labor force participation, these aren't just economic problems, they're existential ones too. Without something worthwhile to do, people flounder. Of course, you don't have to find purpose at work, but purpose gives you something to live for, some why that drives you forward. The third pillar of meaning is also about stepping beyond yourself, but in a completely different way. Transcendence. Transcendent states are those rare moments when you're lifted above the hustle and bustle of daily life, your sense of self fades away, and you feel connected to a higher reality. For one person I talked to, transcendence came from seeing art. For another person, it was at church. For me, I'm a writer, and it happens through writing. Sometimes I get so in the zone that I lose all sense of time and place. And these transcendent experiences can change you. One study had students look up at 200 feet tall eucalyptus trees for 1 minute. But afterwards, they felt less self-centered, and they even behaved more generously when given the chance to help someone. Belonging, purpose, transcendence. Now, the fourth pillar of meaning, I found, tends to surprise people. The fourth pillar is storytelling, the story you tell yourself about yourself. Creating a narrative from the events of your life brings clarity. It helps you understand how you became you. But we don't always realize that we're the authors of our stories and can change the way we're telling them. Your life isn't just a list of events. You can edit, interpret, and retell your story even as you're constrained by the facts. I met a young man named Emeka who'd been paralyzed playing football. After his injury, Emeka told himself, "My life was great playing football, but now, look at me." People who tell stories like this, "My life was good, now it's bad," they tend to be more anxious and depressed. And that was Emeka for a while. But with time, he started to weave a different story. His new story was, "Before my injury, my life was purposeless. I partied a lot and was a pretty selfish guy. But my injury made me realize I could be a better man." That edit to his story changed Emeka's life. After telling the new story to himself, Emeka started mentoring kids, and he discovered what his purpose was, serving others. The psychologist Dan McAdams calls this a redemptive story, where the bad is redeemed by the good. People leading meaningful lives, he's found, they tend to tell stories about their lives defined by redemption, growth, and love. But what makes people change their stories? Some people get help from a therapist, but you can do it on your own too, just by reflecting on your life thoughtfully. How your defining experiences shaped you, what you lost, what you gained. That's what Emeka did. You won't change your story overnight. It could take years and be painful. After all, we've all suffered and we all struggle. But embracing those painful memories can lead to new insights and wisdom, to finding that good that sustains you. Belonging, purpose, transcendence, storytelling. Those are the four pillars of meaning. When I was younger, I was lucky enough to be surrounded by all of the pillars. My parents ran a Sufi meeting house from our home in Montreal. Sufism is a spiritual practice associated with the whirling dervishes and the poet Rumi. Twice a week, Sufis would come to our home to meditate, drink Persian tea, and share stories. Their practice also involved serving all of creation through small acts of love, which meant being kind even when people wronged you. But it gave them a purpose, to rein in the ego. Eventually, I left home for college, and without the daily grounding of Sufism in my life, I felt unmoored, and I started searching for those things that make life worth living. That's what set me on this journey. Looking back, I now realize that the Sufi house had a real culture of meaning. The pillars were part of the architecture, and the presence of the pillars helped us all live more deeply. Of course, the same principle applies in other strong communities as well, good ones and bad ones. Gangs, cults, these are cultures of meaning that use the pillars and give people something to live and die for. But that's exactly why we as a society must offer better alternatives. We need to build these pillars within our families and our institutions to help people become their best selves. But living a meaningful life takes work. It's an ongoing process. As each day goes by, we're constantly creating our lives, adding to our story. And sometimes we can get off track. Whenever that happens to me, I remember a powerful experience I had with my father. So Several months after I graduated from college, my dad had a massive heart attack that should have killed him. He survived, and when I asked him what was going through his mind as he faced death, he said all he could think about was needing to live so he could be there for my brother and me, and this gave him the will to fight for life. When he went under anesthesia for emergency surgery, instead of counting backwards from 10, he repeated our names like a mantra. He wanted our names to be the last words he spoke on earth if he died. My dad is a carpenter and a Sufi. It's a humble life, but a good life. Lying there facing death, he had a reason to live, love. His sense of belonging within his family, his purpose as a dad, his transcendent meditation repeating our names, these, he says, are the reasons why he survived. That's the story he tells himself. That's the power of meaning. Happiness comes and goes, but when life is really good and when things are really bad, having meaning gives you something to hold on to. Thank you.
In 1931, Herman DeVry founded a university rooted in technology. Today, DeVry University continues that spirit of innovation and fusing tech.
Okay, so her name is Emily Smith, but let me find out where I have it here. Estafazi, something like that. Oh yeah, here it is. Emily Estafani. Estafani. Emily Estafani Smith. There's more to life than being happy. It's about the 50th TED Talk back, if you go on the list of TED Talks.
What's the title of it?
There's more to life than being happy. So, the question comes up, what gives you meaning? So let's reflect. Why don't you just reflect on it for yourself? Either write it down or think. In my life, what's the most meaningful? What, you know, what makes sense to me about my life? So just think for a moment. Just think what it is. You know, what thing or things give you the most meaning in your life? What gives you meaning in your life? What is the most meaningful thing or things in your life? So Okay, so right, okay. So when people are really unhappy, one thing to ask them is, what's meaningful to you? And if there's nothing that's meaningful to the person, then help them find that which gives them meaning. And for many of us, it's some kind of social thing. It's working on something to make the world better. And when you get involved in that, you know, that's why people do volunteer work. They get involved in that, and suddenly that becomes really central to them. It becomes really important to them. So that's a huge therapeutic issue and a huge therapeutic help, is to help people find that which gives them a sense of why they're alive. So I want to tell you about the difference, a graphic difference between happiness and meaning. It has to do with children. Okay. Study after study after study, and as of like 12 years ago, there were already over 200 such studies that showed that having children makes you less happy. When they give you a pager, or when they have a, you know, they have now a phone, and 10 times a day they ask you, you know, your phone asks you, who are you with? What are you doing? How happy are you, 0 to 10? And they get all that data and they collect all that data. It turns out that especially having young kids through the teenage years, it's hard. There's so much stuff you have to put up with when they compare them to a control group of people that don't have kids. The people who don't have kids give higher ratings for how they feel moment to moment than the people who are changing diapers or arguing with their teenagers. However, so that's the happiness is the children, at least for a while, or at least at points, depress your happiness versus if you didn't have them. However, when they ask people, what's meaningful to you in your life? People who don't have children say, God, I wish, you know, and people who have children say they were a pain in the, but man, is it, you know, so meaning, and would you exchange the one for the other? The meaning is more powerful, is what she's saying. The meaning is that it at some level gives you a different kind of happiness than your moment to moment how good or bad you feel. Okay. Robert,
I really have to wonder if there's some rewiring that goes on in the brain that makes people genuinely feel that and wonder how real that is. So I actually just had this experience just a couple days ago at the Science and Engineering Council. This woman was a professor at UCSB, pioneering some amazing devices for diabetics to make their lives infinitely better. And yet, she was very quick to say that the most important meaning in her life is being a parent. And I've heard this many times, and it's like, that makes no sense at all. So
it actually does. There's something called oxytocin, yeah, produced by the hypothalamus,
yeah,
and oxytocin is powerfully reinforcing. And when you even think about your kids, you get a squirt of oxytocin, and it makes you feel really good. So that's one mechanism why even thinking about your kids makes you feel yes. When, if you don't have it, you know, not. But there's another evolutionary reason, we can look at it in terms of evolutionary psychology, which is what life wants is for life to continue, and if you participate in that process, you feel like you're living properly, and if not, you don't. And it's why people that don't have kids, they see other people, the work, the help they give to people, or the causes that they are involved in, as their, that's how they parent the world. We all have this impulse to help life move along, and it's deep in our, it's as deep as we're alive.
Did they put into that equation parents of adult children?
No, they didn't, they didn't do that. Okay,
that's
didn't,
the payoff.
They didn't say that. Okay, Sarah's next and then Paula. Sarah and then Paula.
I live in beautiful Santa Barbara. Margaret, and I started living here because my brother happened to find a place that was inexpensive and good for me to live. My life is miserable. My children live far away. My youngest is 50 years old this year, and they don't need me anymore. And I can find no other way to make myself happy is to go home, which is 100 miles from here, and spend my any money I have extra to visit the ones that aren't near where they all live. I have 5 children, I have 10 grandchildren, and I need them. I can't be complete, and my life has not been happy since I got here.
So you need to read two things, Sarah. You need to reconnect with your kids, and you need to also find another way to parent the world, because your kids have their lives, and they, you know, so you're going to be ancillary to them. But there is so much social good that needs to be done that will enable that same connectedness.
Well, to follow up on that, I became a minister about 18 years ago, and I never wanted a church. I wanted to be with individuals and help them. And my neighbors, I live in an apartment where you can't live there unless you're 62.
Yeah.
I think I need to get the heck out of there and live where there's young and old and everybody's, and find a way, and I haven't been able to find it in Santa Barbara, to find a way to take my strengths and help other people. My neighbors avoid me.
Okay, so you need to find a volunteer opportunity that matches who you are.
Yeah.
I need to go on. Okay, so Paul is next, and then Claudette. Okay,
is
Paul.
There any way to tease out cognitive dissonance, that people who have suffered through 18, 20 years of child rearing have to believe that they're the most important thing, or else they would suffer crushing anxiety?
I have no rejoinder to that. I think there's probably cognitive dissonance working here. You know, you got to think this is worth it when you're changing the diapers, or when you're arguing with the teenager, or whatever. You know, when you've gone through all that, you have to think, you know, it must have been worth it. It's a classic cognitive dissonance situation. Yeah. So maybe cognitive dissonance is built into our brains for that reason. So there's one more person, Claudette.
Well, I just want to say Santa Barbara has 1,900 nonprofits within this town. There's something for everyone to find their passion and volunteer. Yeah. For a nonprofit, you know, feeding people who are hungry, delivering food to cancer patients, working for Girls Inc., you know, empowering young women to be our future leaders. So I suggest maybe you look at the nonprofits and find your passion in some nonprofit. This is a town that really gives you a place to find your meaning. And I just want to say that.
Wait, what's her answer to that?
Wait, let's not, I don't want to go there. It won't work. Okay, so let's break for today. When we come back next week, we'll talk about engagement and hopefully relationship too, if I don't get too long-winded. All right, see you in a week.